Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
From Santa Anita, a very good Tuesday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports Zone 964, if you're listening to Sirius XM that way. And at our website, stevebeck.com, a little bit more pleasant. I don't know temperature-wise, but it's not raining. So the rain is behind us, it appears. And in fact, a clear sky and should be a beautiful couple of days. The last two at least the extreme western swing of this last trip of 2022 on to Oklahoma City tomorrow, the Springboard Mile, and looking forward to getting that Saturday card drawn, and look forward to it. I'm going to be at Remington for shows Thursday and Friday leading up to Saturday's closing weekend at Remington, and a lot of it, actually a good introduction to it, I thought, yesterday with Carl Broberg, and Broberg, very interesting. A visit, I thought. And this morning, we have to start the live conversations with the latest development. You can't go too many days without another development regarding HISA. And that, you know, that's not a surprise. We certainly knew or anticipate that there's going to be a lot more shoes dropping, as it were. Alan Foreman will join us in about 10 minutes, give or take, and Alan will explain. May have to get a chance to later in the morning, perhaps, talk to Ed Martin as well, because it very much affects the racing commissions. The latest development yesterday, for those that don't necessarily hang on every single communique that emanates in this realm, the FTC itself, the Federal Trade Commission, who is the supervising government agency under which HISA falls, they said that they essentially reject the rules put forth by HISA to administer the drug enforcement side, the testing and enforcement side, the HIWU, as we're referring to it for now, and HIWU, as discussed with Lisa Lazarus last week. But the FTC acknowledged the thorny legal standing and the uncertainty involving the legalities, and essentially, I'll let Alan walk you through how they positioned this, but at a glance, and reading the trade reports, Matt Hegarty and Dan Ross principally, Eric Mitchell too. I haven't gotten to Eric's piece, but well covered, obviously, by the industry journals. And essentially, they said, you guys work out the legalities, and then we'll address the rules. So, what does it mean? Well, in a nutshell, it means that January 1st, the rules that Mary Scalia said to learn as if it were scripture will not be hastily instituted. In a lot of ways, I'll ask Alan this and expect to talk to Eric Hamelbeck as well. This is not a bad development. In fact, last week, Ed Martin and RCI, the Racing Commissioners International, they actually kind of implored HISA to delay the implementation of this. And, you know, for the, and again, I should probably just, you know, wait 10 minutes until we talk to Alan, but, you know, for the bomb throwers that seem to insist that anyone that is in favor of a delay and of taking time and making sure that, you know, all parties are represented appropriately and have input, this, you know, this only seemingly will, you know, delay what, you know, what everybody's looking forward to having, which is the uniformity. I mean, you heard that. I didn't really spend much time with Graham Motion. We didn't get to that topic with Graham. You know, but you heard Carl Broberg reference it. I mean, somebody that's operating in basically, you know, four right now, Oklahoma. Where's he running? Oklahoma, Louisiana, Illinois, and Arkansas. So, I mean, the more jurisdictions you send horses out under your name, under the absolute insurer rule, the more you're for uniformity and consistency. So no one's saying not to implement this. And, you know, the people who, you know, immediately assume, oh, well, you're for cheating. And anybody that, no, that just so ridiculous that's the response. So Alan will tell us what happens next. Every time we get one of these signposts along the way, the question, you know, becomes, what are the next steps? But to some degree, this does feel like, and again, like I said, after the Fifth Circuit decision, and I asked Alan and Eric, and even Lisa Lazarus last Wednesday, isn't this an opportunity to get this right and to address the concerns? The question is that, you know, does that work? Can that work? So, all right, Alan in about 7-8 minutes. Meanwhile, a couple of other pieces of news, and the gaming, the New York situation, we'll get to. Let's swing back to the swing back a little bit to the Jason Service plea deal and change of plea. It triggered a statement from the Jockey Club of Saudi Arabia, who is holding the Saudi Cup monies in escrow. I doubt it's actually in escrow, but it is continuing to be on hold. And they issued the most non-statement you'll ever want to see. Over the coming weeks, we will assess our ability to conclude this investigation. We're going to figure out if we can actually make a decision. in a robust and comprehensive fashion. So, meanwhile, you know, as we'd said, yesterday. The Gary West understands and acknowledges that the purse should be distributed to the horses that finished behind Maximum Security, and Midnight Bisou being the horse that stands to be elevated. And in fact, I would like to, I got to reach for Jeff Bloom, because there was news over the weekend too that Snapper Sinclair is going to stand in New York, so we can get Jeff's thoughts on both topics actually. So that statement drew some eye rolls and other appropriate emojis around the intranets. There was a very nice update that came as part of a story from Dave Grenning. And Dave, who of course we acknowledged can't come on until March, can't come on until Gotham week. it's a tradition here. After Cigar Mile, Dave can't come on until until next year. The nice horse end of the story involving George Weaver and Cindy. The horse part, you'll see it under the headline "Today's Flavor Romps Again," and big allowance, or actually a maiden win, and then a allowance romp on Sunday, and George looking to state bred stake opportunities for this Leoban gelding that Paul Redham owns. And this is one of those, this is, how often do we talk about these? I mean, usually a lot of times involves Mark Hennig, New York bred that ends up in California for the Redhams, and then ultimately comes east. So this is the latest edition, and the uplifting part of the story, Cindy, who of course over the summer, just a devastating at the beginning of the summer at Saratoga, a 2 year old that she and George owned went down and fell on Cindy, and severe traumatic brain injury and other assorted fractures and I think collarbone and you name it. So there was a real question as to how the recovery prospects, and they've exceeded expectation, and much as everyone anticipated that Cindy would fight as fiercely as anyone possibly could, she's exceeded timing, and is home, is rehabbing. George says that they've gone out, they've gone out a little shopping, and went out for dinner. She needs some assistance at home, but left side it's going to be difficult. But it's so much better than what was initially feared. So as always, every time, we haven't talked about it for a few months, but everybody in the industry, everybody that knows George and Cindy, rooting for and sending the best wishes possible. So I wanted to get that what amounts to a pretty happy, at least positive report. Going to have some more recapping to do as the morning unfolds. Going to talk to Jake Delhomme. And this is going to be an overdue pleasure. Jake with the stake win as part of that Louisiana Champions card. And so we got a first opportunity. I told him it's way overdue that we had him on the show. But this was, frankly, very good timing, because this this horse of his looks like a very nice, a lawbred and more, touch upon a star, Tim Thornton, and they won the Classic on Saturday. So we've got all that. The rest, I gave you the two-year-old yesterday, but we got the rest of those Louisiana races to recap. And so we'll do it with Jake. We'll talk to Popo later. Mig, I don't know. I don't think he's still clearing snow. They only got 6 inches. Mig will join us tomorrow. So we'll look forward to catching up with Richie tomorrow. And that actually will give us a chance to look ahead at some racing action in New York as well. I'm going to do this. Let's get going, and we'll bring in bring in Alan and get the details, because this development seems I don't know if the word opportune is right. Some people will chafe at that suggestion. But the timing, certainly fits, the other parts that we discussed last week. And you know that when you hear Alan Foreman twice in a week, that things are moving quickly. Alan, good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Nice to hear your voice again.
These are always enlightening, and I knew the minute I saw the headline flash yesterday that the FTC called a timeout on HISA as well, and the implementation of those HIWU rules. Explain to everybody what happened yesterday.
So, quite frankly, I don't think this comes as a great surprise. There are a number of organizations, including the THA, and people like myself, certainly Ed Martin from ARCI, the HBPA, had been urging HISA not to move forward with the implementation of the anti-doping program, and to ask the FTC to delay the implementation. Quite frankly, and I think I said it on your show last week, the Federal Trade Commission had not yet approved the anti-doping regulations. Today is December the 13th. The implementation date was intended to be January 1. There were no final published regulations. The education of the industry to the changes that are forthcoming really, quite frankly, has not happened yet. And so we were clearly, with the court decision from the Fifth Circuit argument before the Sixth Circuit last week, it's a very untenable situation to move forward. So I actually think that the decision yesterday by the FTC probably was not only a smart move, but probably was a bit of a relief to HISA from the standpoint that if they had moved forward, it probably was just an invitation to more litigation. As again, I said last week, I think we were getting into a situation where, given the confusion over the constitutionality or whether HISA is constitutional or not, there could be increasing litigation around the country that could just consume the program with uncertainty and issues that it didn't need. So I actually think that yesterday's move should have been expected.
With that, and I made the same suggestion that, given so many parties concerned about what those regulations and certainly the way, Mary Scalay had floated them to the public and given the timing, it does feel, Alan, like there's some advantage to taking some time. And I as you referenced, Ed Martin, I mentioned that Ed had also called for a delay. What are the benefits, and how? I'm basically asking you the same question I've asked repeatedly as this has moved forward and two steps forward, one step back. What are the advantages, and how do you take advantage? How can HISA take advantage? The jurisdictions, HBPA and THA, how can everybody go forward successfully with some pausing here?
Well, I'm going to give you some real-time examples of how successful, for example, we've been in the Mid-Atlantic and what I think it means for the industry going forward. I probably didn't answer your first question, and that is the Federal Trade Commission determined yesterday to reject what's called without prejudice the proposed anti-doping program that had been submitted to the FTC for approval. Under the statute and under federal law, HISA must get the approval ultimately of the Federal Trade Commission before any regulation can take effect. It was done with the safety program, has to be done with the anti-doping program. And because of the decision by the Fifth Circuit determining that HISA facially is unconstitutional, which applies to several jurisdictions, and now the Sixth Circuit looking at the same issue, that kind of uncertainty, the FTC said yesterday, undermines the fundamental purpose of HISA, and that is to bring uniformity to the industry. And you cannot have uniformity when you have any number of jurisdictions that are not going to be covered by HISA or potentially would not be covered by HISA and others that would. It's just an untenable situation insofar as uniformity is concerned. So here's how it kind of plays out, and it's still complicated. First of all, as we've all read and we understand, HISA is seeking to get Congress, currently in the lame duck session, which goes until January 3rd, the lame duck session of Congress, to make fixes to the statute that would satisfy the concerns of the Fifth Circuit, where they believe would satisfy the concerns of the Fifth Circuit. That is one potential resolution, although even that fix could result in further litigation and challenges that the fix itself doesn't still solve the problem. The problem is what's called the non-delegation clause and the extent to which the Federal Trade Commission has oversight of the HISA program, and which at least was determined by the Fifth Circuit to be substantially insufficient. So the first fix is they could fix it in Congress, and if they do so, this has to be, whatever happens here has to be to the satisfaction of the Federal Trade Commission, that if it's determined that the congressional fix is sufficient, the FTC would have to republish the regulations for another 60-day comment period. So best case scenario for HISA and the industry that supports HISA under this scenario would be still months of delay, assuming that Congress fixes it during the lame duck session, HISA republishes the regulations. I think you're looking at it probably at least a six-month delay under that scenario. And quite frankly, our suggestion to HISA had been delay the program for 6 months, even if everything fell into place, to allow for sufficient education, allow for sufficient compliance by the industry, since things have dragged out so much. Second option is that the Sixth Circuit, which is expected to issue a ruling probably within the next several months, that decision is really going to determine the future course, absent a congressional fix. Because if the Sixth Circuit disagrees with the Fifth Circuit and finds HISA to be constitutional, you have a conflict between circuits, and there would be an appeal to the United States Supreme Court. And under that scenario, it would be more likely than not that the Supreme Court would hear the case. And if they do so, you're looking for, unless this is deemed to be an emergency, and if they took it during this term, you wouldn't probably get a decision until sometime in June. That's assuming the Supreme Court takes the case. On the other hand, if the Sixth Circuit determines HISA to be unconstitutional and agrees with the Fifth Circuit, you have no conflict. There would be an appeal to the United States Supreme Court, but there's no guarantee. And there are a number of experts who feel it is unlikely the Supreme Court would take the case, which would then pretty much suggest that HISA is unconstitutional, needs to be rewritten, and HISA would not continue in business until either there is a new statute, a new fix, or whatever. Heise in the interim, so that's how I say this is complicated. The mandate from the Fifth Circuit has not yet been issued. Expectation is that mandate, which will, their order would then go into effect, and Heise would not be enforceable as to the states that are covered by the Fifth Circuit. That does not go into effect until January the 10th, which created your untenable situation between January 1 and January 10. Heise could seek a stay of the Fifth Circuit ruling, and in the absence of, and if the stay is granted, and in the absence of a ruling from the Sixth Circuit, Heise could continue to enforce its programs. We won't know that until the mandate is issued and whether any stay is issued, which then implicates the safety program. And Heise takes the position that it's going to continue with the safety program. But it begs the question of what the FTC said yesterday, and that is, without uniformity, the fundamental purpose of Heise really falls. And therefore, if you have a safety program that's not enforceable in a number of jurisdictions, does it make sense to then seek to enforce, you know, the safety program when you're in this area of uncertainty? And that's not for me to determine. That'll ultimately be determined. I'm just pointing out what the potential minefields are in this as we go forward. So what do we do? It's business as usual, quite frankly. Nothing changes. The commissions in the country will continue to enforce their state regulations, and we move forward now as if Heise did not exist, particularly in relation to the anti-doping program, drug testing enforcement. You know, the safety program, which is something that I really have always thought was the best part of Heise, conceivably could continue. And based upon the work we're doing in the Mid-Atlantic, and we have a Mid-Atlantic strategic plan meeting today, I think it's exemplary to the industry to see what we're doing in the Mid-Atlantic. This is why the safety program is so important.
So from a timeline standpoint, Alan, does anybody do anything to behind the scenes in anticipation? I keep asking this, and nobody seems to want to have an icebreaker, to put all the parties at the same table, so that no matter what happens, everybody is pulling in the same direction, when the other, shoe or shoes drop. I've asked you this, I've asked Eric this, and I asked Lisa Lazarus. I mean, isn't there a summit that would benefit the industry collectively at this point?
Steve, I've been doing this a long time. I have been a champion of uniformity, and I become more skeptical as time goes that that's achievable. And you can get everybody in the room. I'm not of the belief that it's going to achieve a resolution of everybody's issues. What didn't get resolved in Heise, and probably because of the manner in which it was moved through so quickly and the way it was passed, there wasn't sufficient thought given to the relationship between the racing commissions and Heise. I mean, we always champion the idea of a standard-setting body, a set of uniform standards that everybody would have to adhere to. It was one of the problems with the ARCI model rules. They went through a tremendous vetting process, but once they were adopted, enactment by state was voluntary. So some states adopted model rules and some states didn't adopt model rules. And I don't know that dynamic changes unless you have some, I hate to use the word weapon, but some mechanism to ensure that everybody is required to follow the standard rules. And I've seen it time and again, trying to just get agreement, whether it's a void claim issue, whether it's setting a medication standard, I don't care what it is, it's almost impossible to achieve agreement on that. I've seen this play out. I've seen this movie many times. Same thing with the safety program. The other problem with Heise that nobody wanted to talk about and still is the single biggest problem is the cost of the program.
Yep.
Okay?
Yep.
As you know, we were champions of the formation of a compact among the states as an alternative. It would have achieved uniformity. It would have had everybody at the table. It would have been a robust, transparent process, would not necessarily have solved the enforcement issues or the investigative issues, but it certainly would have worked insofar as a safety program is concerned and an anti-doping program is concerned. We couldn't get that done. I think now, as I said last week, there's buyer's remorse. People are taking another look at it. But most importantly, the cost of a compact will be a pittance compared to what Heise is going to cost the industry. And look, I'm not being critical of Heise. They were told to build a new paradigm for the industry from scratch. And I think what a lot of people don't probably know or understand is it was originally intended that the United States Anti-Doping Agency was going to run the anti-doping program, and they didn't want congressional oversight. In fact, some of the constitutional issues that we're now facing are a result of what Heise wanted the statute to read, because they wanted to be the one who had the oversight authority and not some federal agency. But more importantly, the cost of the program, if USADA had done it, would have been more than double what this current program is now costing. It would have been crippling, notwithstanding that there were a lot of problems with the regulations themselves. And so I think Heise felt by not going with USADA and developing HIWU with drug-free sport that it was a massive savings for the industry. At the end of the day, the cost of this program is a major problem and was never thought out, never discussed, and needs to be addressed. So what's going to happen over the next months? We always said, we said to Heise, you need time to educate the industry to the changes that are going to be created by the anti-doping program. They're not substantial. They're not a heavy lift. The biggest problem is in the fact that, and we talked about this last week, we're going to a system of detection times as opposed to withdrawal time guidance. We need to work through that. We need to educate the horsemen. We need to help the horsemen. That has not been done yet. And I think the hope is that in the period of time between now and whenever this gets resolved, there will be an educational process so that if Heise does go into effect, compliance will be, should be very smooth. But I got to tell you, under the current circumstances, I don't know if anybody wants to be educated, because they may feel that this is just not going to happen. So there's a real challenge there as we move forward.
That's an interesting posit, because one thing I mentioned earlier was that it did seem that at some point there'll be a version, Alan. Correct? I mean, there's too much. It does feel like there's too much enthusiasm for an authority of some kind that provides the construct. It does feel like even though those that take issue with some of the short strokes, a lot of the short strokes, and some of the broad strokes, everybody has the same, initial comment, which is we want uniformity. Everybody agrees on it. So under that principle, it does feel like, there's agreement. So it's just a matter of making everybody, as many people happy as it's going to take to get this across.
Well, look, I'll say it again. My bent has been for years uniformity. It's in the Mid-Atlantic region. It's what the horsemen want and what they need. And we're different than the rest of the country. Okay, there are other jurisdictions where uniformity with the rest of the country may not be very important. But to us, it is. And that's why we've continued to work together. That's why we've got the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan. And it works. And it's not a heavy lift. And It has improved both safety and welfare and the integrity of the sport. The numbers speak for themselves. But, you know, I'll give you the one issue where I suspect there could not be consensus, and that's the Lasix issue. It's always been the gorilla in the room. So the compromise that was entered into by those who were able to push the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act through Congress came up with a resolution that really kicked the can down the road and may have set a framework for what ultimately could be a settlement. And that is no Lasix in two-year-olds, and they expanded no Lasix to stakes races.
Right.
And we objected and said it should be graded stakes races, not stakes races, because a lot of jurisdictions, a lot of tracks create stakes to improve their programs from a marketing perspective. And it's just another way to make your program more attractive. The detractors say, no, we want, for black tape purposes, we want Lasix out of the gene pool, so to speak. And then under the HISA statute, there would be a three-year moratorium in the use of Lasix for all other horses, and there would be a study group that would be created to make recommendations at the end of their study to the HISA board on whether to keep Lasix, change the policy, or eliminate it completely. And the way it was designed is it required for whatever HISA was going to do a unanimous vote to make a change. So it only took one member of the HISA board to veto what could be a resolution of the Lasix issue, because these constituencies don't agree. You know, the Jockey Club doesn't agree with the HBPA. The THA may have disagreements. Keeneland may feel one way. NYRA may feel one way. And, you know, Churchill may feel another. You know, I'm just using examples. The consensus on that issue is extraordinarily difficult and, in my eye, remote. So you can get everybody in the room. You can fix a lot of these things with HISA that we now realize need to get addressed, but you're not going to, I don't believe you're going to resolve all the other issues to the satisfaction of all the constituencies that are involved in horse racing.
Fair enough.
I hope I'm proven wrong, but yeah. But that's the reality. I mean, let's be frank. Yep. That's the reality. And, but I know before you kick me off, I got to tell you that we always said that if you follow the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan program, HISA is not a heavy lift. So we're 5 years into the Mid-Atlantic program, and we're meeting today, and we've compiled statistics for 2022. We still got a few weeks left in the year. But I have to tell you that I need to call out two jurisdictions. One is West Virginia. And, you know, we've all been critical of West Virginia for being engaged in litigation to knock down HISA. But if there is a jurisdiction in this country that has made remarkable changes to its program and who has shown a commitment to the safety and welfare of the horse and the integrity of the sport, it is West Virginia. We've watched as their fatality rate has dropped, but this year their positive test rate is substantially lower than it's ever been. They were the highest in the region. They're now among the lowest. It is a remarkable transformation of what's going on in West Virginia. And in Pennsylvania, which had one of the higher fatality rates in the region, they have substantially reduced fatalities in Pennsylvania through their program, which dovetails with the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan. And so, you know, since in the past 10 years, we've seen almost a 40% drop in the region in fatalities. We saw a 4% drop so far this year from last year. When I referred to Pennsylvania, the fatality rate decreased 43% in the last year. And we've seen, you know, racing fatalities drop. So that 99.85% of Mid-Atlantic starts were completed without a fatality. And that's, our program is emulated by HISA. So, you know, follow the program. It's not a heavy lift. And the industry benefits, the horse benefits, we all benefit.
This has been kind of the mantra, you know, going back to to 2010 and those initial findings from the aqueduct study. Then they were reinforced by the fallout from what transpired here at Santa Anita. I mean, every time there's been a serious spate of injury and fatalities, we've learned more, and the dedication to surfaces and to pre-race examination and all the different things that all the different drumbeats, Alan, that have come out of those, and the industry, the database that Mary Scalet created. I mean, there's just a lot of positives that kind of show that things are better than people want to acknowledge. So
this program works.
Yeah,
it really does work. It's had buy-in. From a medication standpoint, HISA proposes, as we've always argued, to divide drugs between anti-doping drugs and those therapeutics that are used on a daily basis. The anti-doping substances are going to be handled very aggressively by HISA through arbitration. I've looked at the statistics here for 2022. There was one class one positive, I think that one, two, or three. All of them, I believe, would fall under the category of no fault contamination, however you want to look at it. I don't see any doping violations. So everything else would be handled essentially administratively with fines. So as we've always seen, the violations are in the class four category of non-steroidals, corticosteroids, we see others, but it's very impressive how this region has shifted. And interestingly, the positive tests are down, and we had a shift from Truesdale, which was a laboratory that was very deficient, to Industrial, which is among the best in the country, and yet we've seen a decline in positive tests.
Yeah, that's encouraging, and the message here really is the line between the dots is shorter than people want to make out. So, Alan,
absolutely,
as always, invaluable. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Steve. My pleasure. Anytime.
Alan Forman, everybody, and there's your update on what transpired yesterday and what has to happen here going forward. When I say that about the connecting the dots, it is a shorter, shorter line between dots than people want to make out. I promised, or at least I threatened, a Jeff Bloom visit, and here it is.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good, Jeff. I thought of you. I've been thinking about you regularly. For starters, of course, we've got the matter of the Saudi purse, and this is one of those. One of those strange trust funds that you wait and wonder, and then I saw the news about Snapper that I've been sort of waiting, and it came as a little bit of a surprise that Snapper is going to make his way to New York and stand at Joe McMahon's. So I said, we need Jeff Bloom.
It was an exciting last few days, that much I can assure you. No question.
Interesting, at the very least. All right, let's start. You know what? Because it's less complex, let's start with Snapper. And he's been, he's been sort of out there marketed, it seems. And he's got an interesting pedigree. I'll discuss it tomorrow in particular with Sid Fernando. But talk about his retirement and what transpired to make a deal and bring him to New York.
Well, here's a horse that, if ever deserved an opportunity to present himself as a stallion, at Snapper Sinclair. Of course, I'm biased, but at the same time, I mean, if you look at the body of work, Steve, from start to finish, when you think about his maiden at Saratoga, sprinting, going 5.5 on the turf against some of the best turf horses coming out of that race, and then going on to compete against the best handicap horses, going two turns, and doing this all the way up into the age of 7, and still competing as strongly as ever as he did at the start. And I think there's still a lot of folks out there who are big fans of City Zip, you know, sure. And so it's a short crop of remaining individuals out there that take on the City Zip line. So I you know, Snapper Sinclair's got a lot of fans. He's arguably one of the most recognized horses we've had, you know, in our portfolio. And I can't tell you how many times traveling with Snapper Sinclair, I'd have people show up saying, well, we just came into town because we wanted to see that big white face of his in person. So it's really exciting. And Joe and Mike and John, the entire team at McMahon, believe in Snapper. They're over the top excited about the prospect of standing him at their place in Saratoga, and they had a showcase weekend on Saturday, or showcase event, and Snapper was one of the surprise entrants for that, and all accounts are he was very well received, and like I said, I'm biased, but rightly so.
Yeah, and what's interesting about him, you mentioned City Zip, and the, you know, the versatility that he offered as a stallion himself, the interchangeability between turf and dirt, the soundness, the longevity of Snapper. You made what, 39 starts. There's a lot here. He's a four generation outcross, noticing, and we'll let Sid kind of talk about some of the advantages that the pedigree potentially offers, and I know that, you know, there were other suitors too. I mean, this was you had wide interest in Snapper.
Well, you know, it's a tough thing, and I don't have to tell you, Steve. You know, to make a stallion, and it's such a fine line in terms of, you know, what particular horse becomes of interest to the stallion market and what region. And, you know, there's no question Snapper was whiskers away from what you'd call, say, a Kentucky stallion. You know, he was on the Derby trail, and you know, he ran such a heartbreaking loss in the Risen Star, losing by a nose, although I'm still not sure he lost that race. You know, and, you know, he finishes second, you know, as an older horse in the very tough Cigar Mile, you know, the grade one at Aqueduct. And so, you know, there's so many check boxes for a particular horse like this. And, you know, we as owners of Snapper just felt he really deserved an opportunity. And so, you know, we didn't necessarily have to retire Snapper, but at the same time, he deserved to be retired. And we're just so fortunate that the McMahons believed in him as well. And a big shout out as well to our friends at Mill Ridge Farm, Price and Healy Bell, who not only have been taking care of Snapper for us since we kicked him out away from training, but really, really gave us a big boost of confidence, big supporters of our program and Snapper in particular, and they a huge assist to those guys as well, and making sure that this deal could happen. And then of course, when you look at the longevity of Snapper's career, Steve Asmussen and his entire team, what a great job of managing and training this horse from start to finish, and allowing us to experience the ride that we had with him.
Well, Snapper Sinclair in New York, and I guess this leaves with, you know, with him leaving, I guess CZ Rocket is the City Zip that is still out there running, but there's fewer and fewer. It really has gotten this. I imagine this will be, you know, he'll be very attractive. How many? I suppose you'll bring mares yourself, right? To him.
We're going to support the heck out of him, Steve. Yeah. I mean, we're going to send. I you know, we talked about initially having a minimum of 15 mares, but I would guess the number will be closer to 20 mares that will end up supporting Snapper with. And we have some quality mares that we've built up in the program recently that we fully intend to send to Snapper. So, you know, we combined with McMahon of Saratoga, you know, really look to give Snapper as good a shot as you can hope for, and the rest will be up to him. But for all the reasons we've talked about, and ignoring up to this point, you know, the physical. I mean, he's a spectacular physical too. So he has all those key elements that you look for, you know, when you're talking about a stallion. And now it's just, you know, hurry up and wait for the paint to dry as it takes a while. But, you know, it's a process. And while it doesn't move incredibly fast in terms of, by the time before you turn around, we'll start seeing some of his babies out there on the racetrack. You blink and here you are. So,
well, we look forward to that. And I've been sort of anticipating this for months, that this topic would come up.
Months.
Yeah. Well, yes, because we happen to have noticed his nameplate on when we were out the September sale, when we went out to Mill Ridge, and there he was in one of those stallion sheds, and I said, all right, where is Snapper going to land? So now we have the answer. Speaking of landing, Bizu could still provide some happy returns to the Bloom Racing team. Your thoughts about what transpired here over the last 4 days, give or take, with at least the Jockey Club of Saudi Arabia acknowledging that there's an investigation that will conclude at some point.
Well, I'm curious, Steve, what news could you be referring to?
Well,
it's been an incredible journey. And as you said, first of all, I mean, my gosh, Midnight Bizu, you know, I've said it so many times, words can't describe. So here we are, the news came out recently with the Jason Service incident and pleading guilty. And then, of course, the owners of Maximum Security, the West, in a very classy fashion, indicating that they believed that there should be a redistribution of the winner share. So, you know, it's what can I tell you? I on so many levels, Steve, more than anything else, it's such great validation for the accomplishments of Midnight Bizu. I mean, when you think about her resume and what she accomplished, and the fact that a filly went over to Saudi Arabia on the world stage against the world's best handicap horses on dirt, and she's just a blip away from winning that race against a horse that admittedly had been provided with PEDs. It's so gratifying for her to know that, you know, she deservingly, you know, gets the accolades and by virtue of her accomplishments and really what she did over there is just mind boggling. And, you know, I still to this day get goosebumps thinking about that. And while it's frustrating on so many levels that she was having to compete against that situation, you know, thankfully, you know, it finally played itself out, it's a big relief.
Well, it's played itself out to a certain degree. It won't play. It really won't play out until there's a wire transfer. How confident are you that you at some point see a purse distribution?
Okay, well, so I have about as much information that you have in terms of sort of following the news and what is currently going on with the Saudi Jockey Club. But one thing I can tell you is that I think there's no mystery right? They're this sort of smoking gun, so to speak. Jason Service pled guilty, and they specifically talked about that particular horse, Maximum Security, having been given those drugs. And so I respect and understand that their organization, there's a process, and you know they are, I'm sure, have been following the details of the news, and I'm also quite certain that as a whole they would like to put this whole nasty mess to bed and move forward, because the event itself and the folks at the Saudi Cup are incredibly professional and gracious in the way that they've put on this event. And when you talk about on an international stage in such a short time to be able to in sort of encourage participants to to come to this event and make it what it is. So look, I think all of that being said is my long way of responding to your question. I mean, I would hope that this would on short order get to some reasonable conclusion of, you know, all the facts are out there now. And I think Midnight Bizu even more so stamped her professionalism, her abilities and her accomplishments, knowing now what we know and what she was competing against.
Well, just offer best wishes that this is, you know, that this sees a resolution, and an adequate resolution, because it is not, they have not been all that forthcoming. I mean, in terms of and even that statement yesterday was murky at best.
Yeah, I mean, look, I haven't. It's been a long time since I've had any communication. I've been following the news in the same way that you would have been following the news. I know that, you know, they certainly are aware of the importance of timing and like I said, you know, getting to a conclusion on putting this whole mess behind. And I think, you know, as indicated, the mystery is no longer out there. You know, it's, you know, I think it's pretty black and white. You know, it's pretty much to the letter of the law in terms of getting the answers that they would have been looking for with what transpired. So, like you, I'm anxious for this to be resolved. And yes, it's one of those things. Look, it's been a long, long journey getting to this point, and so, you know, you sit back and you wait, and we'll. We'll look forward to hearing from them and the end result here.
All right. I won't. We'll be waiting along with you. And before we wrap, let me, Jeff Bloom with us, bloomracing.com, for everything you'd want to know about the operation, including the wrap-up for 23 or for 22 and the prospects going into 23 with some two-year-olds about to turn three, etc. Jeff, what's your benediction for 2022 and to look forward to for 23?
Kind of ready to put 2022 or 2022 behind. I mean, it was a weird year for us, you know. I think part of it is just sort of the cycle of coming out of the whole COVID mess, and we've got some young horses in the program, sort of in our farm system, that are coming up that we're pretty excited about, and really a couple of our, what we think are our best two-year-olds, including one from the family of Midnight Bizu, a filly we have out in California. We have some stuff coming up that hasn't really had an opportunity to get out there yet. But it's been a weird year, Steve. I mean, we've had pockets of, like, you know, decent success, but in the end, probably not our most accomplished season. And I'm ready to move forward and look to the future. That's for sure.
Well, appreciate the opportunity to talk about the developments with Snapper and McMahon Thoroughbreds, the pending resolution of the Saudi Cup and potential. I mean, the earnings side of this, you know, even though it's sort of an artificial number, but it would put her earnings at 12 million. What would?
So I don't know that I would coin it as artificial on my end. But,
no.
Yeah, I think what I mean. when it all comes through, it'll push her above the $14 million mark, I believe. So
amazing.
Pretty crazy when you think about it.
It is. And of course, we haven't mentioned the transaction from the bloodstock sale either in November, selling for $5 million.
Yeah, I think I realize that it's probably not a bad idea to try to go out there and locate, identify another Midnight Vizu-like opportunity.
Well,
such an easy thing to do.
Yeah, there's lots of fillies out there that rack up $20 million in accrued generation of revenue. Yeah,
less the 80,000 plus taxes that we had to pay for.
Jeff Bloom, everybody, and BloomRacing.com. And, of course, Jeff puts together groups and obviously all these different areas, whether it's racehorses and the breeding side, and has just carved out at this point, extended run of success in all areas. Jeff, best wishes for the end of the year, and we'll see you out here somewhere, right, soon?
Likewise, Steve. Thanks so much. I always enjoy catching up with you guys.
Jeff Bloom, and you can follow Jeff individually or as Bloom Racing. He's got both the Jeff Bloom and Bloom Racing connections, and also, of course, as mentioned, the website, beautiful website with all the horses. That Saudi Cup purse that would offset if it wasn't a great year, 2022 for the team, that'll offset it. Well, an hour in here, we'll take the sun's up. It's a beautiful morning, crisp and cold. A lot of that snow that came yesterday up in the mountains has already melted, which is interesting because it was cold all day yesterday. It never warmed up. Today it's supposed to get at least into the 60s. It never got. Whenever I looked in the car, it was 50 something. So the sun is coming, and the activity here at Clocker's Corner has stepped up. First person I saw this morning, which makes it official. Mark Glatt, as always. It was interesting. I haven't had a chance to say there's Jack Carava. I haven't had a chance to kid Carava. He doesn't have to come out as early as he used to as a jock agent, right? Simon Callahan down there as well. I saw Owen Hardy this morning so far. And, that's about it thus far. It's still early, of course, in terms of, you know, the meet just now less than 2 weeks away, 13 days away. And so I guess that would mean entries will be a week from Wednesday, right? Or a week from, let's see, no, it's a Monday, right? So a week from Friday. If they're, I haven't looked at the condition book. So, top of the hour upon us, and thanks to Alan Foreman for his visit, and Jeff, we will take the break, and when we come back, Jake Delhomme will go down to NOLA and talk about his stake win, which I think it's his first stake win as a trainer. I mean, the family, certainly, their operation has won plenty of stakes. But I think under Jake's name, I think it's the first. There's also a story, speaking of Louisiana, that I'm chasing down, we got to get to, which is from the Fosters. If you have not seen, you know, most people cringe when it comes to gender reveals. However, if you haven't seen the gender reveal, which pits two workmates in pink and blue, that's, yes, exactly right. Workmates together at Louisiana Downs, and whoever was going to come out ahead at the wire in the workout, that was the gender reveal. If you haven't seen it yet, it's very funny. It's catching. I don't know if it's viral yet.